The book of Ruth is a story of women in a men's world. It is a well-crafted story where form and content combine in order to affirm the clever strategies and courage of women. God doesn't make an appearance. Ruth and Naomi know hardship, danger, and death. No omnipotent God promises them blessing. No man rushes to their rescue. Instead, they risk bold decisions and shocking acts. They are working out their own salvation. There are four distinct acts in this drama. Act one concerns the plight of Naomi. She is a Jewess who, with her husband Elimelech and two sons, fled from a famine in Judah to the neighboring country of Moab. There the boys marry local girls. Then disaster strikes. Her husband dies. Her two sons also die. The famine, too, comes to Moab. In a patriarchal world, the security and survival of women depends on male patronage. Naomi's cultural worth without husbands or sons is negligible. She is now reliant on the goodwill of kinsmen in the extended whānau. Naomi therefore wishes to leave Moab, return to Bethlehem, and seek out such goodwill. Her two widowed daughter-in-laws want to come too. Naomi is touched. Indeed, she sees in their gracious loyalty the graciousness of God. Note the power of this. The author is proclaiming the presence of the Jewish God in pagan female foreigners. Naomi, however, orders her daughter-in-laws to return to Moab. She tells them that she is past marrying age and therefore cannot attract a man to shelter them. She tells them that being a foreigner without resources in Judah is no picnic. She tells them their chances of remarriage and therefore security are better in Moab. One of the daughter-in-laws reluctantly agrees. Ruth, however, does not. "Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge," she says to Naomi. I always smile when I hear that passage read at weddings. Not many, if any, of the wedding guests realize that these are words of fidelity spoken between two women, between a mother-in-law and a daughter-in-law. Ruth's choice makes no sense. She is forsaking the security of her own kin and her own gods. In the entire epic of Israel, only Abraham matches this radicalism. And then he had a call from God. No God has called Ruth. Further, Ruth has reversed sexual allegiance. A young woman has committed herself to an older woman rather than to search for a new husband. One female has chosen another female in a world where life depends on men. There is no more radical decision in all the history of Israel. Act 2, they're now in Bethlehem. And we're told about a wealthy kinsman of Naomi's called Boaz. Ruth went out to collect grain, as the poor were permitted to do, behind the reapers in a field belonging to Boaz. As chance would have it, he happened to pass by. Chance, fate, luck, whatever you call it, in this story is the silent handiwork of God. Yet fate, as Naomi and Ruth knew too well, can be a fickle thing, raining both curse and blessing where it wills. In order for fortune to smile, fate needs courage and daring deeds. Boaz asks in classic patriarchal prose, "Whose maiden is this?" In other words, who owns her? The question might fit the culture, but not the woman. The servant says she came with Naomi from Moab. Boaz then graciously directs her and protects her. Concern for this foreigner marks Boaz as a true child of Israel. Ruth's response is deferential. Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me? It is also ironically subtle. This inferior foreigner, by choice and by chance, created this situation. Her deference results from her daring. At evening, Ruth returns to her mother-in-law with food and relays the day's events. Naomi is delighted that a kinsman has been so kind and they will not starve. Ruth is pleased that she can provide for the two of them. There's no inference that Ruth is sexually attracted to Boaz. Act 3. Naomi takes over. Aware of the kindness of Boaz, she begins to act upon it. She does not wait for matters to take their course or for God to intervene with a miracle. Rather, she plans an outrageous scheme. Ruth is to dress in her finest clothes and go alone at night to the threshing floor, where the men are drinking and eating. After Boaz has laid down to sleep, Ruth will approach him, uncover the lower part of his body, euphemistically called his feet, and lie down. Just how much of the lower body is uncovered remains tantalizingly uncertain. Naomi concludes, "Then Boaz himself will tell you what to do." Ruth agrees. The suspense-filled question now is, how will the patriarch of Israel respond to this bold action by a foreign woman? All went according to plan. Midnight, Boaz stirs and sees Ruth. "Who are you?" "I am Ruth, your maidservant," she replies. Up to this point, Naomi's script has been followed. However, instead of Boaz telling Ruth what to do, Ruth tells Boaz, "Spread your cloak or wing over your servant." The wing or cloak refers to marital and physical security. Yes, she is proposing to him. Consistently throughout this book, we have a portrayal of Ruth as a defier of custom, the maker of decisions, and the worker of salvation. Boaz's response is characteristically gracious. He calls her a woman of worth. The story's audience breathes a sigh of relief. Ruth and Boaz are going to get it together. Yet there is a hitch. Legally, the closest kin to Naomi's dead husband has the right and obligation to take Naomi, and therefore Ruth, under his wing. Boaz is second in line. He must go and see if the matter can be resolved by the men. Act 4 begins with the elders conferring. No women are present. The unnamed nearest relative is happy to take Naomi under his wing when he learns that Naomi has a little parcel of land. But when the unnamed relative learns that Naomi comes with a widow, Ruth, another mouth to feed, he wants to renege. The inference is that he's greedy. He wants the rights without the obligations. Ruth and Naomi are now within Boaz's household, and the men see Boaz as having achieved this. The patriarchal concern for seeing the name of Elimelech, Naomi's dead husband, continue has been achieved. The story, however, doesn't end in the male court. It returns to the women. This is a woman's tale about women's achievements. Ruth has now conceived and borne a son. The women of Bethlehem rejoice. Rather than identifying the child as a son of Elimelech, they see him as the son of Naomi. They speak of Ruth the bearer rather than Boaz the begetter. The book of Ruth can be read as a tribute to patriarchy. Woman's worth is found in getting married and having sons. Yet to read the book in this way is to miss the tremendous hope and courage of the women involved. This is a tale about moving from death to life, about surviving poverty and vulnerability. It's about surviving in a climate of prejudice and patriarchy. It is a man's culture where wealth is blessing and poverty is curse, where God favors Israelites and men. Yet within that cultural world, by daring deeds and a sprinkle of fate, by fidelity to each other and struggling forward, Ruth and Naomi have triumphed. Ruth appears in the genealogy of her great and many times great grandchild, Jesus. She appears there with three other unexpected, bold and brave women, in stark contrast to the usual men-only genealogies. Her name is included in order that we Christians not forget. I think she would have been proud of her far-distant Mokopuna, Jesus, and he of his ancestral granny.